in kind of a strikingly different way. Abraham is praying on behalf of Sodom. Moses is praying on behalf of Israel. And that's fascinating, not just because here is the father of the faithful praying on behalf of Sodom, and he's not saying, God, come get him. What he's doing is appealing to God based on who he is to act in the way that God should act. But he's doing so for a Gentile community, a group of outsiders. They weren't called Gentiles back then. They're a group of outsiders from the covenant. But that's particularly appropriate for Abraham to be doing because Abraham is the one through whom all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And he prays for the outsiders. Moses, however, is the first great leader of the fledgling nation of Israel, the one who gives the law of Moses. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? The law of Moses is given by Moses. It's very complicated things we deal with in the Bible sometimes. Here he is, the giver of the law, the leader of the people, and he's interceding for the insiders, so to speak. And I don't want to make too much of that, but certainly it shows us that intercession is part of what good leaders do. And they will intercede for those on the inside and those on the outside. And maybe there's a lesson all on its own just in that basic idea. But as we work our way to this prayer in Numbers 14, there are a variety of interesting and important contexts to think about. First is Moses' early life. Everything leading up to him becoming the leader of the people of Israel really seems to have been an exercise in learning how to be an intercessor. Learning how to be a middleman. He has to decide to identify with his people instead of the Egyptians who raised him, if you remember that story. But what happens very quickly is he winds up stuck in the middle between an Egyptian who is beating a Hebrew. And very soon after that, he is inserting himself into an argument between two Hebrews. And that doesn't end well. And so he flees for a while, and he's out in Midian for a while. And then God brings him back. Why does God bring him back? Because he wants him to be the middleman between himself and Pharaoh. And he does that for a while. And then he appoints Moses to be the leader of the Israelites, where he is the middleman between God and the nation, which is the role that he will have for the rest of his life. So the role is middleman between God and Pharaoh dominates most of the early part of the book of Exodus. The role as middleman between God and Israel is really the rest of his life. And they will constantly complain about their circumstances. And they will complain about their leader. And they will complain about their God. And he himself is at odds with Israel very frequently. And God is at odds with Israel even more. Really, they create situations which force God to be at odds with them because of their sin. And in those moments, Moses must stand in the breach and repair the damage. And a very early example of this is the golden calf. And this is why I told you to turn to Exodus chapter 32 to begin with, which is an intercessory prayer. It's one we won't talk about because it's so similar to Numbers 14. And so I'll just make a couple of comments here. But the golden calf incident at Mount Sinai is, it's very early on. He has been working with the people of Israel for a little while, and they have left Egypt, and they've only been gone for a few days. I mean, we're not talking about Moses 40 years later with everyone who knows him really, really well, for better or for worse. This is early in this entire thing. And he goes up on Mount Sinai to receive the covenant from God. I don't know if you've ever heard this sort of analogy before, but I've heard the golden calf incident compared to a wife cheating on her husband on their wedding night. Because of the analogy, which is frequently used as God as the groom and his people as the bride, and that's part of it. And the analogy is frequently used of idolatry being equated with adultery, or sin even being equated with adultery, breaking the covenant in that sense. And this is so early on in the process, I've heard that analogy before. And if you're married, or even if you're not married, you can imagine the horror that it would be if, you know, you get to your hotel room after your wedding and you decide to go out to the ice machine and you come back with a bucket of wife to find your spouse in the embrace of another person that very night. How horrific that would be, right? But in reality, it's actually worse than that, because it's not that the covenant had just been given. The covenant was in the process of being given when they are making the idol. This is less their cheating on God on the wedding night. It's more their cheating on God during the wedding ceremony. That's how bad this sin is. God has rescued them. He's brought them out. He is making them His covenant people in a special dedicated relationship. And they're already building another idol. It's no wonder that both God and Moses are furious at this. Even so, Moses pleads for them. Notice in verse 11, Moses implored the Lord his God and said, "O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you've brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, 'With evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth'? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, 'I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I've promised I will give to your offspring, that they shall inherit it forever.'" And then drop down to verse 31. "So Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They've made for themselves gods of gold, but now if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of the book that you have written.'" And again, this is very similar in some ways to Numbers 14. If you want to start making your way over there, that's where we'll end up soon enough. It's very similar to the prayer there, and so we're not going to consider it separately, except I want to just make very briefly a comment to notice Moses' focus on this prayer. His primary concern is twofold. It is God's glory and God's covenant. What are people going to say about you, and what is it that you have promised? And as he goes to God in this moment of intercession, those are his primary driving forces. And that's what we'll see again in Numbers 14 here as well, which is why I wanted to bring that up. A second context that I think is important to think about here is God's self-revelation to Moses. Shortly after the scene in Exodus 32, Moses will ask God in Exodus 33, "Show me your glory." And God says, if I may paraphrase, "Nope, can't do that, you'll die." And he says, "I will show you something of my glory, though." And I don't know exactly what it is. The text says, "You shall see my back." I don't know what that means in terms of, again, quantifying it and describing it in scientific terms. I'm not sure what that means. One author said that he saw the trailing edge of God's glory, which I think is maybe a good way of putting it. That as all of God's glory passes before him, the final thread of the final hem of the garment of God's glory is the last thing he catches a slight picture of. And I don't know if that's a way of describing it either. Whatever it is, God says, "You can't see my glory. I will show you something of my glory. You will see my back." And in Exodus 34, when he does reveal himself, what he shows him is the glory of his name and his character. He speaks his name and then describes himself in Exodus chapter 34 and verse 6 as a God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. And that word itself that gets translated steadfast love is a word that means that, and it means mercy, and it means faithfulness. And it is a word that almost always shows up in the context of a covenant. It's a word that becomes associated with God and His covenant. But more than that, that statement that He is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love becomes the refrain of the Old Testament. That is the phrase that is used more than anything else in the Old Testament. that he is a God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. It'll show up in our prayer in Numbers 14. It shows up in Nehemiah 9. It's in Psalm 86 and 103 and 145. It's in Jeremiah 15 and Joel 2 and Jonah 4 and Nahum 1. And maybe a couple of others that I missed. It is the refrain of the Old Testament. He is a God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Well, finally, as we think of the context of this prayer, it's important to get right up to the moment. In Numbers chapter 14, we find the people on the border of the promised land, and yet again, they are grumbling. They have sent the spies into the land, the spies have come back with a bad report, and they completely lose their trust in God. Or maybe they never had any trust in God to begin with, is the problem. But whatever there might have been is gone. And in Numbers chapter 14 and verses 1 through 4, all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night, and all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for them, for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Here is their repudiation of the leadership of Moses. We'll pick a new leader. But this is the leader God picked. And so it's a repudiation of the leadership of God. It's a refusal to go where God told them to go. It is a rejection of all of the promises that God had made since Abraham. This is not a minor little paragraph here. They are turning their back on everything that God had been doing since he called Abraham to leave his homeland and made promises to him. God's response shows his intense frustration, to say the least. He asks in verse 11, "How long will this people describe me? How long will they not believe in me in spite of all the signs that I've done among them? I'll strike them with pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make you a nation mightier than they." That "how long" question, we'll talk about tonight when we talk about Habakkuk. That is a question of lament. That is a question that shows up all over the book of Psalms and other places where people are crying out to God in their agony. How long is it going to be this way? And in the Bible, when something is repeated, it is being emphasized. You know, they didn't have bold italic underline to emphasize things. Repetition was a strong way of emphasizing. When God asks the question of lament twice, "How long, Moses? How long is it going to be like this?" This is a frustration that has been building for a while and is being shown in these words. "I'll just destroy them and disinherit them and start all over with you." But Moses said to the Lord, "Then the Egyptians will hear of it, for you brought up this people in your might from among them. And they will tell the inhabitants of this land, 'They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people. For you, O Lord, are seen face to face, and your cloud stands over them, and you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now if you kill this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of your fame will say, 'It is because the Lord was not able to bring the people into the land that he swore to give them, that he's killed them in the wilderness. And now please let the power of the Lord be great as you have promised, saying, The Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. Please pardon the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of your steadfast love, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until now.'" You know, Moses' intercession here speaks volumes about the sort of concern that a person should have in the face of divine judgment for sin. I mean, it doesn't get any clearer that judgment is coming and judgment is about to happen than this scene. And seeing how Moses reacts to this moment tells us something very important about that. And yeah, Moses is worried about the fate of the people. But ultimately, Moses' entire focus is on God. He asks about the people. But his eyes are not on them. His eyes are on God. He is looking at God. He is concerned with God. And that has to be the case, right? What defense can the people make for themselves? There's no defense that can be made for them. They don't even seem to be interested in making a defense for themselves. Forgiveness can only come from God. God must be the focus in times of judgment. But notice in particular, there are a couple of things about this that really stand out to me. Two in the prayer, then I'll say one thing about something after the prayer. First, Moses is focused on God's glory. Moses is focused on God's glory. He is jealous for the reputation of God. What Moses says is, if you do this, Egypt is going to hear about it, and they're going to misconstrue it as failure on your part. And they're going to tell other people the same thing. And you know what? Other people have been watching what has been going on. We get that with Rahab, right? She's heard about their victories. That's why she wants to come over to their side. Moses knows the same thing. Other people have been watching. Other people know what is going on. They've heard of you, and they will think the exact same thing. This God of Israel is unable to do what he promised. Some God that is. Oh yeah, I'll deliver you from Egypt. Oh, look at them. They all died in the wilderness. What a great God Israel has over there. Surely they couldn't be expected to understand that God deals in covenants. God demands responsiveness and obedience. In their minds, all gods worked the same way. And the way their gods worked were superficial human kind of thinking. After all, they're gods that were made in man's image. That's what those idols are. And they function in terms of power. And that's about it. And so if God fails, he doesn't have any power. Notice Moses' concern for God's reputation among non-Israelites. Moses presumes that they are watching. Moses presumes that the people of God and their fate is being followed by the onlooking world to see whether God could fulfill his promise or not. And his concern is that God would be glorified. His concern is that God would be glorified not only among his own people, but also among the nations. Indeed, the Israelites were called to be a light among the nations, Isaiah says on a couple of occasions. They failed pretty miserably at that, but Moses was concerned for that. That they would be a light to the nations. And notice also that in his concern for God's glory, it is his concern for God's glory as opposed to his concern for his own glory. Moses is faced here with the opportunity to become the head of his own new nation. And how easy would it be for Moses to say it this way? The head of my own new nation. A nation that will clearly be greater and more glorious than this rebellious lot has ever been. I mean, there was nobody short of God who was more frustrated with his people than Moses was. I can guarantee you that. I mean, if I was Moses, thank God I'm not, right? If I was Moses, I'd be like, yep, go. I will step out of your way and let you do what you want to them. I've been wanting to do that for months. So please, pestilence, send it away. That's not Moses' perspective. Moses' only thought is what this scenario would do to God's glory. Secondly, Moses is concerned with God's character. Moses appeals here to the greatness of God's power. Please let the power of the Lord be great as you have promised. That is such a fascinating statement. And it's, I'm trying to decide if I want to talk about this now or a little bit later. Let me go ahead and say this now. What do we think of when we think of the greatness of God's power? I mean, in this context, the Exodus, right? 10 plagues, parting of the Red Sea, pillar of cloud, pillar of fire, water gushing out of a rock, the pyrotechnics at Mount Sinai, the conquest of the land, the greatness of God's power, the flood, maybe, the miracles of Jesus, a mountainside Elisha sees filled with fiery chariots of the angelic host, the greatness of God's power. Please let the power of the Lord be great, as you have promised, saying, the Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. What if the true greatness of God's power is His ability to forgive? In Isaiah 55, there's a familiar verse that talks about God's thoughts being greater than our thoughts and God's ways being greater than our ways. And that is true on a general level. But in Isaiah 55, if you read that text closely, it's talking about forgiveness. That is the way that Isaiah is emphasizing how far God outstrips the greatest of humankind, is His ability to forgive. It's not God's destructive power that Moses is concerned with. It's God's positive power, a power that is inherent to His character, because that's what He revealed to Moses back in Exodus chapter 33. Where Moses takes his stand is on God's self-revelation. He goes so far as to quote God to himself. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? This is what you've said, God, and so this is what I appeal to. You have manifest your character and your promises and your relationship that is rooted in your patience and your mercy. And so God, Moses says, be who you are. That's Moses' prayer. You've said this is who you are. Be who you are. Moses summons God to his own self-resolve. It's an appeal to God's grace based solely on God's claim to be gracious. That's the only place Moses can go, because there's nowhere else to stand. Israel doesn't deserve it. They deserve nothing but God's wrath. There is no penitence in Israel. There is no confession in Israel. There is no hope for Moses to base his plea on, except for the fact that God said He's gracious. And so Moses goes to God on that basis alone. There is no implication that they deserve pardon. There is no implication that God is even remotely obligated to forgive. Instead, it is God who is a God who is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love that is the only place that Moses takes his stand. This is who you have revealed yourself to be, and so that's who I ask you to be. So Moses' concern is for God's glory. Moses' appeal is based on God's character. And then as this story unfolds, we do see what God's grace looks like. In verse 20, the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word. But truly, as I live, and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, none of the men who have seen my glory and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not obeyed my voice, shall see the land that I swore to give to their fathers. And none of those who despised me shall see it. And he goes on to make the exception of Caleb, and that they are all going to die in the wilderness at this point. And we say, oh wow, that's some grace. What mercy that is. God's just going to let them all die. That doesn't seem terribly merciful. Well, God says He will pardon, which is more than they deserve. And otherwise, He gives them what they ask for. And this is at the essence of biblical theology. A lot of people struggle with the doctrine of hell. You know, how could God, an all-loving God, send someone to a terrible place like that? And I don't know the definitive answer to that other than the Bible says God will do it. But I think a big piece of it is that God gives us what we ask for. And if we spend our entire lives saying, God, I don't want to have anything to do with you, at the judgment God says, okay. And I'm not entirely sure how we think that's unfair. Well, they've all said it'd be better to die in the wilderness. Okay. He pardons them from their sin at the moment. He allows them to continue to live. He will allow them to have a new generation, and their descendants will enter the promised land. The ones who said, you know, our little ones will be devoured. No, the little ones will be just fine. They'll take the land. You who said the land will devour us, well, interestingly, in a couple of chapters, the land is going to literally devour some of them because they didn't go into the promised land. The people received the death in the wilderness they asked for, and they received far more than they deserved, which is forgiveness, continued life, and a second chance with a new generation. God's mercy doesn't have to suit my desires in order for it to be mercy. We don't get to dictate what mercy looks like. And so as we look at this, I think it's important to think of how God displays His grace, because He does display it, and learn something from that as well. All right. Well, I don't remember what time I started. I know we have 45 minutes, and there'll be a five-minute bell. So I think we've probably got about 10 minutes or so. Thanks. I got a sign in the back. We got 10 minutes. So with 10 minutes, the question is, what do we learn from this prayer? And I've got a list of things up here, but I always think it's interesting to see what other people see in it. So questions, comments, accusations, what do you got for me today? Yes, sir. Okay, so how Moses is like Jesus, I'll try to remember to repeat things as they're said because I don't know how well it's heard in the auditorium around. So how Moses is like Jesus, how Moses is a foreshadowing of Jesus in terms of being an intercessor. That is a point that I tend to, especially if I was preaching this as a sermon instead of a Bible class, it's where I would be more inclined to end, because Moses' intercession for his people is a lot like Jesus in some ways, and it also shows us why we need someone better than Moses at the same time. And the failings of Moses' intercession, not to blame him for anything, but it can only do what it can do. And Jesus as an intercessor is a whole different kind of intercessor. I mean, Moses dies and has to be replaced. Jesus is an intercessor who lives forever, always living to make intercession, as the author of Hebrews tells us. His blood is continually available to cleanse from sin. And, you know, with Moses, as you read through the wilderness journey, if you're reading through it for the first time, again, we kind of take biblical stories for granted because we know them so well. If you're reading through some of these things for the first time, you're probably going to think at some point, is it going to work this time? Is God going to forgive them this time? Have they pushed it too far this time? And that question of, you know, is Moses' intercession going to pull it off again? Well, that's never the question with Jesus. Jesus' intercession is always successful. It will never not fail. And so, yeah, the connection to Jesus, I think, is an important thing to think about, and, you know, kind of comparing and contrasting is to better understand that. What else? Yes, sir.
You hit on an important part about the glory of God really being His restraint. And that, too, is a reflection of Christ, is it not? And that ultimately is what Christ did by going to the cross. That He set aside His divinity in order to make that sacrifice. And that's the ultimate reflection of restraint. Is that what this alludes to?
Yes. Yeah, and until I was studying this, I don't know how many times I've read this in my life up to this point, but until I was studying it for the purpose of teaching it and writing about it as well, I somehow never read the greatness of your power and then a quotation about forgiveness and noticed those things were connected. The greatness of God's power is His forgiveness. That's a very different way of thinking about God's power. Yes, sir.
Well,
you see that example of compassion here with Moses, again, the foreshadowing of Jesus, but the suffering of others. And we have many opportunities to live that out in our own lives, the suffering with others, the necessity for doing that. It would have been a lot simpler for Moses. He said, yeah, take him away, and you promised me these special privileges.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, I think that applies, certainly applies to Jesus, but it applies to our lives as well. We can ignore the needs and of others, but yes, we've got this.
Yeah, let me say two things, kind of building on that comment. Moses' love for his community is an amazing thing, given the community that he has. And I use the word community intentionally because it's such an ambiguous word. What do I mean by community? I mean, my community is, in some sense, my, you know, family. My community is, in some sense, the congregation that I'm a part of. My community is, in some sense, the subdivision that I live in. It's the town that I live in. It's the nation that I'm a part of. It's the human race. The word itself has many layers of meaning, and that's why I chose to use it, is what does it mean for Christians to have love for your community? That when you see your community in a state of sin, that you want to do something about it. What does that look like? Well, it would look different in my little four-person family than it would look in my small congregation, and different from still in the greater Tampa area or whatever else the case may be. So I think that's an interesting thing to give some thought to, and I don't want to provide answers and specifics, but give you that as your own thought and reflection question. What does it mean to love my community and to care when they're in sin? And with that, the fact that the believer is an intercessor. And that is a really interesting thing because it's not the way I was necessarily raised to think. You know, Jesus is our intercessor. God is the one who saves. We can't, you know, yeah, Jesus fills the role of intercessor in a way that none of us can. But I highly doubt that the Bible gives us so many examples of believers praying intercessory prayers so that we can studiously ignore them and never do that. That seems a little counterproductive. Illogical, whatever word you want for that. And so the believer as an intercessor who goes to God on behalf of people who don't deserve it, we should be doing that. And again, I'll leave that with you to think about what does that look like in my life, in my situation, with my communities, and so forth and so on. Let me pose a question for you. Is it ever okay to pray against God's will instead of for God's will? The right answer to that is no, right? Well, of course not. What kind of stupid question is that? Moses, I will destroy them and disinherit them and start all over again. No, God, don't. Now, we can quibble about what God is doing in making that statement, which is its own gigantic theological issue. But God has just told Moses what his will is. And he immediately pleads that God does something different. That is something to wrestle with. That is something to think about. And what I would say is that this boldness that Moses has in this moment is rooted in a relationship that he already has with God. It's rooted in a knowledge of who God is and what God is doing. It's not like God comes along to someone he's never seen before and says this, and then the person starts arguing with him. Moses is someone who has a pretty good handle on what God is up to with this people, what God's promises are, what God's intent is. I mean, we sometimes think that, you know, the Jewish community in the first century and even beyond has elevated Moses to too high of a height. And I wouldn't argue with that, except that I'd say we sometimes, in response, lower him too much and don't realize how special of a man this was. No less than God himself said, there is no one like Moses who I talk to the way that I talk to him. This guy is a pretty big deal. So when he shows up saying, wait a second, God, let's think this through, you know, this is not a spur-of-the-moment thought, a fleeting emotional need. He's no stranger before God with some bizarre new idea. It is rooted in a very well-established relationship with God that has included him being constantly a mediator with God. And so that's something I think we need to give thought to. Here is someone who is praying against God's stated will. In what circumstances is that something to consider doing? Or is it never something to consider doing? Is it only something that someone like Moses can do? And those are the sorts of practical questions to wrestle through with this text as well. Well, I've got one more thing on my list, which I could talk about plenty. So, yes, sir. Yeah, thank you.
Right.
So if you didn't hear that, this is a change from who Moses was when he got angry and killed someone early in his life. And so now, plenty of reason to be angry. And so not exactly the same thing as Jacob we saw earlier, but still the transformation and growth of an individual is something to add here. Yes, sir. Yes. So, right. So, when he's concerned for the people, Moses is going in the right direction. When his concern becomes self-focused, his glory, he goes in the wrong direction and things go off the rails. All right, I'm going to not comment on your comment so we can have more time. Yes, sir. Yeah.
I might be the one. Part of that development of Moses is that he gets away from things still frustrated to the point.
Yeah. Yeah, as patient as he was in a lot of ways, as much as he cared about them in a lot of ways, he still had his breaking point. And there's again your contrast with Jesus as intercessor too. Yeah. Constant concern for God's will. Any other thoughts? Well, yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, sir.
And you talk about praying against God's will. It seems to me the examples that we see are cases where, Abraham negotiates for Sodom, but it's not for his own will, it's for someone else's. In each of these cases, they're negotiating with God, not for themselves, but for someone else. Against God's will.
Right.
So it seems to me that seems to be the premise in which God will put up with that, as you will.
Right. And to be fair, I stated it that way because it was provocative. I was intentionally being provocative when I asked that question that way. Was Moses praying against God's will? Well, ultimately what Moses says, and this is my last point, what Moses says is, "Let your power be great as you have said. I'm a God who's slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love." Moses roots his plea in God's character. And God's will is only a manifestation of God's character. So when he says, "God, be who you are," is he praying against God's will or is he praying in line with it? And that's what I want you to think. And I wish we had time to talk about a whole bunch of these prayers, especially in the Old Testament, because what you see in Old Testament prayers more than anything else is people who go to God and they say, "God, this is what you have said, and so this is what I'm asking for." God, this is who you are, and so this is what I'm asking for. God, this is your series of promises. God, this is the nature of your covenant, and so this is what I'm asking for. It gets so repetitive that it either drives you crazy or it's one of the most profound things you've ever seen in your life. All of the faithful people in the Old Testament are constantly going to God and saying, God, this is what you have already communicated that you wanted, and so that's what I'm asking for. Have you ever wondered, how is it that I can know whether I'm praying according to God's will? Step one, who is God? Step two, what has God promised? Fill your prayers with those things, and you will never go wrong. If God has already said He wants something for you, that should be part of our prayers. God's promises have not been given to us so that we can know what we can take for granted. God's promises are given to inform us what it is we should be pursuing. And we pursue that in part in prayer. Thank you so much for your kind attention today.